The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
From Lebanon into Israel.
Wow!
A barrage of rockets lands dangerously close to homes and shops in the country's north.
Here is the spot where the rocket landed.
The sender, unknown, but Israel is blaming Palestinian militant group Hamas for the attack, while Lebanon's leader has condemned the use of his country to stage such acts as Lebanese troops and UN peacekeepers try to find the perpetrators.
From 2006, it was peace, quiet, super quiet, but now it's very, very surprised.
Israel says its Iron Dome intercepted most of the rockets and one man was injured. The country's leader had this message for those responsible.
We will strike our enemies and they will pay the price for any act of aggression. Our enemies will see that the citizens of Israel stand united and unified.
Yes, Israel is striving to defend itself from all these enemies that have decided to open up a three-front battle against the Jewish state. That one, of course, was Prime Minister Netanyahu. So he's got enemies without and enemies within. This is what we're going to be talking about on today's program. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Brett Nachtigall, filling in for Mr. Stephen Flurry, coming to you from our Jerusalem, Israel office. Stick around for the second half of today's show. I'm going to be talking with archaeologist Christopher Eames about the period related to the Exodus and the archaeological evidence that has turned up over the centuries. Of course, we are right in the middle of, or right to the end of, the Days of Unleavened Bread, when Israel was making its trip out of Egypt and then culminating on the last day of Unleavened Bread as it went through the Red Sea. So stick around to the second half of today's program. I'm sure you're going to be very interested in that. So as Mr. Netanyahu is talking about, we have this interesting situation that's developed in Israel over the past 2 weeks that's incredibly dangerous because of the attacks that Israel is now receiving from three different fronts. And of course, at initiating this attack on Israel are the Iranians. Everyone that attacked Israel over the past 2 weeks find its patron in the Islamic State of Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. First of all, you had attacks on Israel from Syria first, and then from Gaza, and then from Lebanon, and then from Syria once again. I have an article. It's entitled "Iran Kickstarts Multi-Front Middle East War Against Israel," and this is by Jerusalem Post's Seth Franzman. It was published on April 9th. This is what he writes. A week of attacks on Israel, including rockets from Lebanon, Gaza, and Syria, represents the manifestation of an Iranian strategy to confront Israel with multiple threats on different fronts. Although different groups may be behind the attacks from those places, these groups are likely all linked to Iran. The groups involved include Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and others that may go by different or new names, but which are proxies of Tehran. So I want to talk about some of these attacks against Israel, first of all, but then I want to put it in the larger context of what Prime Minister Netanyahu has been facing over the past 2 weeks. This is a time of intense division inside the nation of Israel. This has been covered, I think, quite a bit by Mr. Stephen Flurry and others, Sam Livingston, covered some of this, and even Mr. Richard Palmer. So there, we have been covering this story over the past month or so in Israel. I just want to give you a bit more of an Israeli perspective of it, and perhaps a bit of a closer view, given that we live here in Israel. So you have these attacks, and on the face of it, they might not be seen as too intense or nothing that, let's say, Israel's defense forces can't handle. Further down here from Seth Fransom, and he writes this, "The Iranian threat has not gone away, and its proxies and allies appear to have begun a multi-front conflict with Israel over the past week. This involved the Iranian drone operation on April 1st, which came from Syria, so this is to the north, northeast across the Golan Heights. Gaza rocket fire from April 5th to 7th, so this is where Hamas, its terrorist proxy in the Gaza Strip, is located, and also Islamic Jihad, another terrorist proxy of the Iranians. They fired rockets against Israel. And then you had 34 rockets fired at Israel from Lebanon over Passover on April 6th. So this was the largest attack against Israel from Lebanon, rocket attack since the 2006 war, Second Lebanon War. So this is intense. This is a statement by the Lebanese proxy of Iran, Hezbollah. Although they might not have been directly behind these attacks, nothing happens like this in Lebanon without Hezbollah knowing and wanting it. And so this is a substantial change. And then you also had Gaza there was a rocket fire on April 9th from Syria. Now, there were six rockets that were fired from Syria. Now, we don't really hear about this, but you have proxies of the Iranians that have been inhabiting Syria for about a decade now, since the Syrian civil war began in 2012. So they're also firing rockets now. So this is Israel virtually surrounded. And it's not surrounded to the point that these attacks aren't substantial enough to the point that they could take down the state of Israel right now. At least these, 34 rockets here, a couple dozen from Gaza, and then six from Syria. Yet this is a statement by the Iranians that they can attack when they want to. And of course, you also have the shootings that are taking place in the West Bank as well. If Iran could get rockets in there, it would, but Israel maintains all the borders into the West Bank. And so it's harder for them to manufacture or bring in material to use and such rockets. And it would be harder with the IDF forces that are doing consistent raids in the West Bank as well. But you have shootings that are taking place. Three women were killed this week. A shooting attack in a car that was just driving on Route 60 or the main route that goes up from, I think it was Route 60, but one of the main routes inside the West Bank. Terrorist came in front of a vehicle with a mother and two daughters in their early 20s and shot them all. And they ended up, two of them died at the scene, and the mother died just yesterday in hospital. And so you have this period of increased attack from the Iranians, where they are trying to make a statement that they can hit Israel in a multi-front war. And this is the big danger, because when you think about it, you think the IDF forces is very strong, as indeed it is. Can they face off with a prolonged war against Gaza, Hezbollah, and the Iranians in Syria for a prolonged period of time? Of course, the main way that this would happen is with rocket fire, missile fire, and such. And the main player in this, behind the or in front of the Iranians, is Hezbollah, this terrorist organization operating out of Lebanon, virtually controlling Lebanon at this point. They have over 100,000 rockets. So Hamas might have 10,000 in the Gaza Strip. And that's what we hear a lot, Hamas firing rockets into Israel. I think back in 2021, they fired over, a few thousand of those. Well, Hezbollah has 100,000, much bigger ones that can hit anywhere in Israel, and lots of them are precision guided. The ones from Hamas, basically, they try and lob them into Israel and hope that it overwhelms the Iron Dome system, the defensive missile shield that fires these, that shoots them out of the air from the Israeli side. And they hope some of them penetrate to kill Israeli civilians. That's what they're trying to do. Well, in Lebanon, with Hezbollah, you have a far greater threat, 10 times the amount, the arsenal, and far bigger missiles, and these are precision-guided. So not only, the Iron Dome doesn't target every single rocket that is fired into Israel from Gaza, because it can, with its amazing design, it can determine which ones of those rockets are going to land on areas with a populated center. And so it only chooses to fire on the ones that will cause Israeli casualties. So what happens when you've got an arsenal of precision weapons that are all intended to hit civilian targets or targets where there's going to be casualties in Israel? The Iron Dome is going to have to take down most of those if it can. And so this is the greater danger that happens that exists in Hezbollah. So you do have Iran pushing at a certain point. Now it is pushing. Iran, as we've talked about on this program and others, is the prophesied king of the south that is prophesied in Daniel 11 verse 40 to push, throw its foreign policy around, have a very pushy foreign policy. It's just almost now, probably already, has enough fissile material that is at weapons grade for a nuclear weapon. I think it was up to 87% as of a couple of weeks ago, which that's enough for a nuclear weapon. People say weapons grade is 90%, but 87% would be enough. So they have that. So that's going to provide them then with this nuclear weapon umbrella that says that, well, if you hit us too hard, just watch out, we might use a nuclear weapon on you, which makes Israel's decision-making process in how to attack Hezbollah in Lebanon, changes the calculus completely if they have to worry about a nuclear threat, which is why Israel has been trying to stop that for the past two decades, or even before then. And it's coming up to a rock and a hard place, not necessarily from the Iranians, but from the United States that is still pushing for a nuclear deal with the mullahs in Iran. So these are the dangers that Israel faces. And why did it happen right now? I think it happened right now because of the government that Iran is working together, probably not in tandem, but its aims are working alongside the massive internal division in Israel that is designed to bring down the Netanyahu government. That is the absolute truth of it. And it's the reason why last week or week and a half ago, Netanyahu folded and said, we are going to draw down from the protests. We are going to, or at least we're not going to have our government keep on trying to push through this legislative reform. We could have done it, because we had enough seats inside the Knesset and we had a mandate from the Israeli public from the last election to reform the rogue Supreme Court that has unchecked power in Israel. And they were pushing it through, they were going to do it. There'd been one or two votes in the Knesset, the third vote in the Knesset, which is what would see it pass. And yet the Israeli defense establishment, the Israeli media, Israeli schooling system, even the airport, the largest labor unions in Israel, they all went out to protest. And the country virtually shut down. The day that Netanyahu called off, or suspended, the legislative reform, I mean, it was chaos in Israel. I mean, flights were not leaving from Ben-Gurion Airport. They're all delayed or canceled. You look at the board, they're all canceled. So this is the main airport. Tourism's a massive industry for Israel. Everyone's stranded, nobody leaving because the labor union decides that they're not going to put the bags on the planes and so on and other reasons at the airport. So they're not working. No one's leaving Israel. Then you have massive financial institutions that are pushing the government to slow down the legislative reform. Then you have these rumors that Iran is trying to attack more Israel. And you have pilots that are refusing to get up on their planes. You have IDF reservist units deciding that they're not going to, if they're called up, fight on behalf of this government if they keep on going with this legislative reform. And so picking between the destruction, as Netanyahu would see it, of the Jewish state as they knew it, this total collapse and making it vulnerable and weak for outside attack and folding, he decided, well, let's fold for the moment, is what he says. But what we saw was incredible in the state of Israel. We saw the choice that Netanyahu faced was allow these protests to continue that push up against what Netanyahu was voted in to do, allow them to continue and potentially allow them to continue to the point that they burn down the Israeli state from the inside, or fold and deal with the external threats. And Netanyahu decided that, well, I'm going to hold off for now. Now, the big point that everyone latched onto of the reason why Netanyahu tried to, wanted, or at least the protest picked up that day, is because he fired the defense minister, Yoav Gallant. And you know, everyone was very upset by this. How dare he? Because Gallant sided with the protesters. He was one of the members of Netanyahu's cabinet. And so he said, you can't side with the people that are trying to bring down this government and remain part of the government. That's not going to happen. And so that's which led to this cascade of other individuals and groups in Israel trying to fold. So this is a very dangerous situation that Israel faces, and it's hard to see that Israel has faced something like this for decades, certainly not internally. And what you have is a massive disenfranchised right in Israel, a massive disenfranchised right that no matter how the votes work out, no matter how in the last election in November, Netanyahu receiving a huge mandate from the right to push, and what was it for? It was to push legislative reform. And why is this a big deal? Because right now the judges in Israel elect themselves. And right now in Israel, the judges in Israel can strike down any legislation that comes from the Knesset, from the government. There is the power in Israel is in the unelected judges. And honestly, this is where some Israelis are fine with it being. Some of them understand that there's a problem here. That, oh, this doesn't actually work like the United States or others where, you know, there's this confirmation process that they go through in order to, that confirmation process is done with the backing of the legislative branch, the people voted in. So the people that vote in Israel have absolute no regulation over the judges. With Israel without a formal constitution, these judges are able to divine the solutions, the answers, the judgments that they make that can actually strike down the government's proposals, the government's laws. And so this is something, this judicial overreach, activism, whatever you want to call it, has been taking place increasingly since 1986, 1987 in this time frame. And what you have in Israel is just, I mean, we've written about this. I wrote an article a while ago called Israel's Rogue Supreme Court that goes into some of these details. But it is a country that is run by the judiciary. And so Israel, in 2015, votes in a right-wing government. It can't do anything. Why? Because you have this constant pressure from the judiciary saying, no, you can't act that way. No, you can't pass those laws. So it's overwhelming now in November 2022. There's a huge mandate. Netanyahu doesn't have to work together with any leftist parties or center parties or the Arab parties. He can just go in strong, and he was voted in to make legislative reform. And he tries to do it, and he gets shut down. This is just really, really interesting and dangerous. Israel is no longer a democracy already. Already. It's already past that point. Why? Because democracies, yes, they need to be checked by a constitution or something like that. There needs to be fairness and balance of powers. But right now there isn't balance of power in Israel. It belongs to the judiciary. And they can base their decisions to strike down legislation on something that they deem might be considered unfair. So this is what you have going in Israel. You have the attack from without, you have the attack from within, and the attack from within is probably the most dangerous thing Israel faces. But fearing an attack from without while Israel's in chaos, Netanyahu called it off for a time. So this week, what was the opposition leader doing? What was the opposition leader, Yair Lapid? He was the former prime minister. Lapid was in the United States. He was in the United States meeting with several Democrats. He met with Republican Gerald Nadler. So he's not the foreign minister. He's out there doing his own foreign international relations. He's talking with Nadler. Everyone is saying that he's out there to just tell the left in America that, hey, still love us, still love us. He's there as an emissary for the state of Israel. Is he really? Who's he meeting with? This is what Joel Polak wrote. He is one of the senior writers for Breitbart. I think he was based in Israel, or he might be still based in Israel. He wrote this, April 10th, Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid, who has led protests against judicial reform in his country, flew to the U.S. Monday to meet with Republican Gerald Nadler, who has proposed the most radical reforms in U.S. history. So this is interesting. I mean, in Israel, Lapid says, no judicial reform. No judicial reform. We can't have it. In America, he goes to meet with Nadler, who's was the one that pushed the bill to try and pack the Supreme Court, to make it the, available to increase the number of people on the Supreme Court, I think up to 8 or up to 12, so that they can push more of the left-leaning judges into the court and get their will that way. So in America, when the right or the conservatives are in control of the judiciary, we need judicial reform. But in Israel, when the left is in control of the judiciary, then we don't need judicial reform. Can you kind of see how it works, both in the United States and in Israel? And this is what Polak, he writes about. He says this, not only did Nadler propose expanding the court from 9 seats, which has had for over 150 years, from the 9 seats up to 13, get that right. But he also demanded the Senate abolish the filibuster, a key minority protection to do it. And then Nadler said, the American people have had enough. To restore power to the people, we must expand the Supreme Court. And that's just so funny. In Israel, they say the protest to empower the people. We must not reform the Supreme Court. It's amazing. Lapid's trip appears to be an effort to use pressure from outside Israel to affect negotiations between the government and the opposition over judicial reform, which Prime Minister Netanyahu has paused to allow for talks. So you've got Netanyahu dealing with the threats in Israel. You have Lapid going over there, deal with his buddies in the United States. And, you know, this is just, it's amazing to see the left in Israel and the left in the United States and the similarities and what they're trying to do with President Trump and what they've already done with Netanyahu. This is another article. It's entitled Intelligence Leaks and the Consequences of Israel's Resistance Coup. It's by Jonathan Tobin, writing for the Jewish News Syndicate. Really interesting article. It reports on this interesting report that came out from the New York Times on Sunday. This was a leak that came to the Times that said that that the CIA had written an internal document that detailed that the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, was actually encouraging its personnel as well as other Israeli citizens to participate in the anti-government protests that have shaken Israel over the past 3 months. So, you know, there's been the Prime Minister came out and said, not true. It's good Mossad came out and said, not true. But of course, the Prime Minister is going to say that. He doesn't want the more fracturing in the nation, more division in the nation. So he's going to come to the defense of the Mossad. But does that sound familiar somehow? That you had an anti-government, anti-Israel, I would say, protest taking place, and Israel's CIA, Israel's Mossad, is actually encouraging their personnel, or at least the fact of the case that we definitely know happened is that the Mossad went to the Attorney General, which absolutely hates Netanyahu, and said, hey, can we let our personnel go and protest? And the Attorney General didn't say, well, actually, first and foremost, the Mossad should really be there to defend the state of Israel and uphold the wishes of the government. No, the Attorney General said, yeah, go to it. Go do it. They're allowed to go do that. So you had the Mossad inside the protests in Israel actively trying to bring down the Netanyahu government. If that doesn't sound familiar to you, you haven't been watching this program much. Well, Mr. Fleury has been focused on the fact that the FBI colluding with protesters in the protests on January 6th, being one of the main players in the protests on January 6th, active that were trying to stop the case being heard on the fraud of the 2020 election in the United States. So you've got Israel's intelligence services backing the protest to get rid of Netanyahu. You have the deep state, the United States, government forces, the FBI, CIA, working together, judicial branch as well, not necessarily the Supreme Court, but the Attorney General and such, trying to work to bring down Donald Trump. And even this indictment is just very interesting because, I mean, you look at what's happened in Israel already. Look at what's happened in Israel already. Netanyahu, you probably already know this, for the past 2 years is under indictment, meaning that there's these cases that were brought forward, the Supreme Court decided, hey, it's worthy to take this case, and they're going to try Netanyahu. They're going to try him for breach of trust, fraud, and a couple of these other things. And what was the big deal? The big why they brought this forward and why the media jumped on board with it and why the Attorney General a couple of years ago jumped on board with this is because they thought, how can it be that we have somebody running for prime minister or even a prime minister that's under indictment? Just go away, deal with the indictment first. And then if it clears up, fine, come back to politics. That's what the left said. And Netanyahu said, well, the case is absolutely fraudulent. I didn't do any of these things, which is what's, you know, that is being proven right now. But they were using the indictment of Netanyahu to get him out of the elections. And he said, no, I'm going to continue to be in the elections. And what do you have? What do you have now? In the United States, you have President Trump's now indicted. And everyone's saying, well, we can't really, do we really want the Republican front runner, the Republican that's going to be on the ballot? Do we want him to be facing indictment, one indictment, maybe another indictment, maybe a third indictment? Do we really want him to come with all this baggage to an election? So they can just, it doesn't matter if they're there's any truth to these indictments, they just get pushed forward, put the man under arrest or under scrutiny, judicial scrutiny, and he shouldn't run. He shouldn't play part in politics. He should be dealing with this by himself. And Netanyahu said, absolutely not. That's not the way it's going to happen. And it's just interesting to see this play out, what played out for Netanyahu a couple of days in the United States. I actually have a little clip here from Piers Morgan. He is interviewing, this is about a week, this is actually the day before the government folded, or at least judicial reform stopped. The government didn't fold, it's still in power. And he's talking to Netanyahu about this indictment that he's facing. And just think about the parallels that are happening now in the United States with President Trump. This is from a week and a half ago with Piers Morgan and Prime Minister Netanyahu.
I think a lot of people go to these demonstrations. They're patriotic Israelis. They want the good of the country. But a lot of them don't actually know the details of the bills, just like I just described. They don't even know that the leaders of the opposition that are now going to these demonstrations, they themselves argued that the court, the way we select judges, should be changed. They themselves did it before the election.
So all these people protesting just don't get it.
Many of them don't. Many of them...
Isn't that slightly patronizing, Prime Minister?
No, I don't think so.
To tell your own people who are protesting in hundreds of thousands...
I didn't say that all of them don't.
No, you implied it. They just don't understand.
Well, listen, you have to see the mainstream media in Israel that is going on this like a huge, huge, huge propaganda campaign.
Well, the added complication for you is that you, of course, are still going through an ongoing trial that is suspended while you're prime minister for corruption and bribery.
It's not suspended at all. It's going on all the time.
So it's going on.
It's going on. And in fact, it's unraveling. The charges, the charges that were put before me were ridiculous. And they're just unraveling in the court. You're discovering things like prosecutorial intimidation of witnesses, the blackmailing of witnesses, tampering with evidence.
But here's the point.
So all of that is coming out.
And Robert, you would agree.
That will be dealt with in the trial. The judges that are going to decide this case have already been selected. Mm. They will not be affected
by
this
legal
reform.
Here's the point I was going to make. Mm-hmm. Is twofold. One, the Attorney General, Gali Baharov Miara, says you've broken the law by directly involving yourself in an overhaul of the judiciary when you're facing an ongoing corruption trial. She said it was illegal and tainted by a conflict of interest.
That's completely false. I maintain the same conflict of interest restraints, and I'm abiding by every consideration. That my case is not going to be affected by this legal reform one iota.
But what happened?
But to insist, I am the Prime Minister of Israel. Mm. Israel is going through the most acute crisis in many years. You yourself said how important it is to say that the Prime Minister of Israel cannot deal with something to try to bring a resolution to this crisis, cannot speak about it, cannot try to resolve this issue, cannot take care of the security of the country, which you yourself say may be impacted by this. This is absurd.
If it was an opposition leader who was in power, who was going through a corruption and bribery trial, I don't think you'd have the same view. I think you'd say there's a clear conflict of interest here.
I'd say no, there isn't, because the trial or my legal proceedings are completely unaffected by this reform.
So the Attorney General, I mean, if the statement is that you've broken the law, you're saying as Prime Minister of Israel, the Attorney General's wrong about the law.
Yes, of course I'm saying it. I said it openly and it's not a question.
So you hear Netanyahu there talking about how, you know, this case, it's already folded up. I disagree with the Attorney General. Of course I do. It's ludicrous. She works for the other side. She's part of the problem in the state of Israel. And here we have the United States facing just really similar things. Just one, I'm going to continue from Jonathan Tobin here. He writes, if true, meaning if the CIA the Mossad, Israel's CIA, was really backing the protests, it would be an excusable violation of the agency's responsibility to remain above politics and to follow the orders of the country's democratically elected government. More than that, it would give some credence to the claims by some of the government's supporters, including Netanyahu's son Yair, that hostile elements inside Israel's intelligence community had colluded with the Biden administration to help fuel the protest with the ultimate goal of toppling the government. So this is interesting because right now you have in Israel, you have the understanding on the right that the Biden administration is incredibly hostile to Israel, to this government, to Israel as a whole, but it's particularly this government is going to do anything it can to help out the protest movement. And that's why you have Yair Lapid, of course, over there already. And so you have even Yair Netanyahu, who's the son of Prime Minister, he's out there showing that the Biden administration is actively hostile against this government and that this is all about, it's not even about the legislative agenda. While it is in part, it is about an effort to unseat a democratically elected government that had a strong mandate to push through its agenda, including judicial reform. They want to get rid of the democratically elected government, and they're going to do it by mass protests in the streets. And where does it stop? Carolyn Glick, last week on her podcast, she talked about this in some ways, and she was actually completely demoralized that she felt like Netanyahu did the right thing. Why? Because the state of Israel was crumbling. It was increasingly vulnerable to outside threats. And when one side isn't happy until you either burn down the state or you get out of power, that's what they're doing. That's what they want. You leave, you stop the judicial reform, and do you think it's going to stop? Like, these protests have continued. There was a freeze from Netanyahu, but protests happen outside our building here, still weekly. The protests continue. They want Netanyahu gone. Nothing in between. Nothing in between. This is what Tobin says here. Israel's liberal establishment fears that the leftist parties that represent its interests can never win another election, and so they have done everything they can to undermine Netanyahu with protests akin to the color revolutions that sought regime change in the former Soviet Union. Indeed, they are so determined to oust the government that they even consider measures that could harm the country's finances or undermine its defense, like the refusal of reserve duty by supporters of the protest to be legitimate tactics. So if the state burns, that might, all these things, it's legitimate because we have to get rid of this government by any means necessary. And that includes even the defense establishment turning on the government, at least some of them. Very dangerous situation Israel is in. And the question then becomes, how does Israel get back from here? How does, yes, Netanyahu's still in power, judicial reform has been halted, how does he govern? I mean, the right here is absolutely furious by this stoppage because We had democracy. There was an election. We voted in this government to do what they were doing. Sure, a bit of compromise is fine on the judicial reform, yes. But how is it that for the past 40 years in Israel, 50 years since the 70s, 40 years, 50 years, that Israel has voted in right-wing governments and is still getting left-wing policies? Why is that? It's because the levers of power, the media, the judiciary, intelligentsia, the academics, they all have strength in Israel to slow down a government from actually doing what the people want that they'll voted in for. So you have this massively disenfranchised right in Israel. I'm not saying everything that is in this judicial reform package is good. Probably there are a few elements that aren't, but this the main factor here is that we've got a bunch of unelected judges that are divining how Israel should be run. That's not a democracy. It's just whatever happens between their heads is going to be the law. And we find that dangerous. Yes, Israel is at fault in many ways. It should have had a constitution worked out in 1948, 49, and 50. It should have done it then and there. But Israel's been constantly facing outside threats that it hasn't had time to suspend everything and just sit down for 6 months and work out a constitution. And now it's too late. So, you know, this is, I've got friends on both sides of this. So I can understand both sides. I think one of the big reasons why a lot of people are upset by the judicial reform is, as they would see it, it puts the hands in the ultra-Orthodox here, which, you know, it has some validity to that argument. That might be one of the reasons. However, you know, you're fighting against democracy still. You are fighting against democracy still in that case. So what is Netanyahu going to do? Where is he going to go to for help? We know that the state of Israel under Netanyahu does need some help. Now, this is just really interesting. Mr. Richard Palmer wrote an article, Benjamin Netanyahu is under attack by America. It goes into several of these instances where you have proof that the Biden administration is backing the protests as well. Funded by the State Department, at least in accordance with some of these NGOs that are trying to get people out to the protest, funded by the Biden administration. You even have President Biden that's refused to meet with Netanyahu up till now. Here's a clip from him just a week ago talking about how no plans to meet with the Prime Minister of Israel.
Like many strong supporters of Israel, I'm very concerned. And I'm concerned that they get this straight. They cannot continue down this road. And I've sort of made that clear. Hopefully, the Prime Minister will act in a way that he's going to try to work out some genuine compromise, but that remains to be seen.
Are you inviting the Prime Minister Netanyahu to the White House, sir?
No.
Not
in the near term.
Just straight up, a flat out, no, no. But now that it's halted, is he going to invite him to the to the White House? Sure. And what's it going to show? It's going to show that the Biden administration backs the protesters 100%. And now that you've been a good boy and you've halted it, now you can come to the White House. Now, what is going on here? Why is the Biden administration, the Obama administration, as they did back in 2015, when they supported the get out to vote by the Arab parties to try and bring down the Netanyahu government then? The State Department funded the downfall of the Netanyahu government then. Instead, Netanyahu prevailed back then as well. But why? Why are they siding with the radical left? Mr. Palmer writes in this article, again, it's entitled Benjamin Netanyahu is under attack by America. He quotes Mr. Flurry in this, writing, when Barack Obama was president, he was terribly unmerciful to the Jewish nation of Israel. But in President Trump's first term, he saved the Jewish nation of Israel, biblical Judah, from much of Obama's tyranny. He supported Israel in many ways, including scrapping the Iran deal, moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, and helping Israel sign the Abraham Accords with Arab nations in the region. Joe Biden has taken America back to the terror-supporting policies of Barack Obama. And that's happening with support for the Iranians, but it's also happening with the support for these massive protests that are trying to bring down the Netanyahu government. So what is there for Netanyahu to do? Now, this gets into a really interesting prophecy. detailed in 2 Kings chapter 14 that Mr. Flurry has written about in America Under Attack and Mr. Palmer writes about in his article here. And it says that there is going to be a return to office for President Trump, and that President Trump is going to have to war to recover his presidency. Yes, but that verse also has a connection to Judah, to the little nation of Israel. So will we see Israel flounder under Netanyahu for a time? And there needs to be a return to the to President Trump, to the White House, before there's going to be some help? What we're seeing here in biblical Judah is that there is no helper, not just in the United States, but all the nations of biblical Israel. There's no helper. Even Netanyahu can't do it by himself. He needs somebody else. And of course, it's going to be God that is raising up President Trump and pushing him back into office because of his mercy on the nations of Israel, not because he's necessarily a righteous individual. But that is going to have knock-on effects felt all the way over here in the little nation of Israel in the Middle East. That's all we're going to have time for to cover this, because I want to make sure we have plenty of time for this exciting interview that I'm going to do with Mr. Christopher Eames, archaeologist here in Jerusalem. He has been researching a lot about the Exodus period to tell us more about how the Bible and the biblical events of the Exodus can be matched up side by side with some artifacts that have been unearthed in the past 200 years. Stick around, and I'll be talking to Mr. Christopher Eames.
The Trumpet Daily. The Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course is a distance learning program that makes the Bible clear and understandable. The correspondence course enables enrollees to learn what the Bible itself says about subjects that affect you and the world you live in. This fascinating Bible course highlights and proves what the Bible says about morality, war, religion, terrorism, and other current events, focusing on the root causes of this world's many problems facing man, as well as their solutions. The Bible and this course also focuses on the reason mankind was created in the first place, the way to happiness, accomplishment, and fulfillment, as well as the truth behind important doctrinal questions, such as what happens after we die, the nature of God, the resurrection, the millennium, and other critical subjects. Enroll today in the Herbert W. Armstrong Bible Correspondence Course. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
So thank you very much, Chris, for coming on for the second part of the show. We're going to talk about, or you're going to talk about, the period of the Exodus and Israel's sojourn in Egypt, and perhaps some archaeological evidence that could corroborate those events almost four millennia ago.
Okay, sure. It's a pleasure to be here. So getting into these discoveries, the first major one I want to talk about is the Ibzhai relief. And this parallels the biblical accounts of the patriarchs and their families going into Egypt at various periods, most famously during the time period of Jacob, but also prior as a result of famine events and that type of thing. Even as far back as Genesis 12, it talks about Abram taking his family, which would have been during about the 19th century BCE, into Egypt. Now, there's this fascinating tomb painting, painting on one of the walls in the tomb of the governor Khnumhotep II, and this dates to the 19th century BCE, and it's called the Ibzhai relief, and it's a fascinating painting of these West Semitic people. So this is from the region of Canaan, migrating into Egypt at this time. So we see a line of people with their mules, with various women and children and men. One man has a harp that he's carrying, and they're being led by this individual called Abisha the Hyksos in this particular segment of painting, which, again, that's a good Hebrew-fitting name. Mm-hmm. And they are migrating, shall we say, or caravanning into Egypt. And there are a couple of particular notable things about this depiction. One is that these people from this area of Canaan going into Egypt are wearing these multicolored garments.
Interesting.
Really peculiar. You don't see this for any other cultures or within Egypt itself. But here we've got these people with multicolored garments being led by a leader called Abisha the Hyksos, and within a time frame that fits with the start, shall we say, of these kind of migrations that are happening into Egypt. So that painting there gives us a really vivid snapshot of a migration of the sort that the Israelites undertook.
So these points or these artifacts, they're from an article that the Armstrong Institute produced. It's called "Did the Israelites Really Live in Egypt?" So if people want more follow-up details, they can certainly get them there.
Right.
Okay, so let's move on.
Okay, just really quickly, the second one is called the Famine Stealer. This is a monumental boulder inscription. It's actually from quite a late period, the Ptolemaic period, so the 3rd or 2nd century BC. But it talks about an event in the far distant past which involved a 7-year famine. Hmm. Now, listeners who are familiar with the biblical account will obviously make the association with the famous 7-year famine, 7 years of plenty, then 7 years of famine from the time period of Joseph. Now, this famine stealer, it talks about these 7 years of famine and how the people in Egypt were suffering. And it talks about the Pharaoh having a dream in which the solution to this problem was revealed and that bounty would come to the people of Egypt once again. So another fascinating snapshot right into this biblical account.
So that's kind of when Israel were still free, and perhaps we can move along to their bondage if you have one from that period or...
Sure. Well, what we see in Egyptian history, in the classical history, and now starting to see more and more in the archaeological record, is this descent of people called the Hyksos, mm-hmm. Variously translated as shepherd kings or foreign kings, into Egypt. And we see that they set themselves up in the northern territory of the land as their own autonomously ruled part of the country, while the native Egyptian kings ruled in the south. And relating to these Hyksos, several interesting scarabs have been found, including... These are like a seal impression, a royal seal stamp. Most famously, one of these Hyksos royal individuals is called Jacob or Jacob in the Semitic language. And so we see the rise of these Hyksos on the scene. And during the 15th century BCE, is when these Hyksos were overthrown by the native dynasty in the south. And this is quite interesting, really relayed on the Carnarvon tablet. So this dates to the reign of Pharaoh Kamos, who again was the southern native Egyptian ruler, who on this tablet is expressing utter frustration with the fact that Egypt is separated into parts. The north is being ruled by these Semitic Hyksos people. Mm-hmm. The south, parts of the south, are being ruled from Egypt. So he, in this inscription, is planning on rising up and overthrowing the Hyksos. And we know, ultimately, that's what happens. It doesn't happen under Kamos. He ends up getting actually killed during battle with the Hyksos. But his brother, who takes the throne after him, he ends up, Amos the First, he ends up overthrowing the Hyksos. Hmm. And controlling all of Egypt proper and ushering in the new kingdom period. So what we do witness at this period as well, so the main base of Hyksos operations was in this northern palatial complex known as Avaris, mm-hmm. or by its archaeological name, Tel el-Daba. And so what they've found at this site is that indeed it started off as this royal ruling area. There's actually a palatial central district with 12 significant tombs there, which is quite interesting. You can look at Patterns of Evidence's documentary Exodus for more good information about that in particular. But what we see is not that this Hyksos or Semitic population fled at that time period, but we see a continued occupation happening now under the new native Egyptian rule at that time, probably under conditions of worsening severity. Hmm. And what the archaeologists have discovered at that site, Tel el-Daba, is that it appears to have been abandoned about 100 years later during the mid-15th century BC during the reign of Amenhotep II.
That's interesting timing.
It is, yes. Who fits in a number of different ways with the biblical account of the Exodus Pharaoh. And you mentioned the website. There's another article specifically on that subject identifying him as the Exodus Pharaoh.
So Avaris is a town that you said was ruled over by Semitic people, and then it gradually looks like it's been there's a degradation in perhaps the quality or the lifestyle of the people. Mid-15th century, it's abandoned. Do we have artifacts which we would then put with the Exodus time period, right, that would fit that?
Sure. There are a few different artifacts we can point to. One most famously is another tomb, that of the master Rechmeyer. His tomb dates to that same time period, about the mid-15th century BCE, and it shows these Semitic slaves mm-hmm. making bricks
right.
out of mud and straw, which is exactly the ingredients talked about in the biblical account. And it also, his tomb, it contains an inscription which talks about how the treasure stores are overflowing. And you pair that again with Exodus 1 verse 11, it talks about the treasure stores that the Israelites built. Hmm. Now, in relation to the Israelites leaving Egypt, there's a famous and fascinating papyrus account called the Ipuwer Papyrus. The version we have of it is from the reign of one of the Ramses pharaohs, but researchers know that it's not from that time period. It's actually a copy from sometime centuries earlier.
So the Ramses period would be when? So this is the actual papyrus with the writing on it is
yes,
from that
so
period?
Yes, so from about the 13th century BC, and the people who have researched this document know that this was just another transcription of it during this time, and actually this account is from centuries earlier. Mm-hmm. So it's a big debate as to when exactly, but with the kind of vague nature of that, that would again fit well with an Exodus event happening in the 15th century, sometime around that period. And this Ipuwer Papyrus is talking about a time of absolute desolation happening to Egypt. Just amazing parallels with the biblical account. If I can read out a couple of them. So I'll jump between the Ipuwer Papyrus, say a sentence from that, and then a biblical line, and you can compare the similarities. So from Ipuwer, we read, quote, "Indeed, the river is blood, yet men drink of it." From Exodus 7, verse 20, "And all the waters that were in the river were turned to blood." Back to the Ipuwer Papyrus. "Indeed, hearts are violent, pestilence is throughout the land, blood is everywhere, death is not lacking." Back to the Exodus account, quote, "Surely now I had put forth my hand and smitten thee and thy people with pestilence, and there shall be blood throughout all the land of Egypt." Back to the Ipuwer Papyrus, another line from that. "Indeed, magic spells are divulged, Simu and Shinu spells are frustrated." So back to the Exodus account, chapter 8, verse 14. "And the magicians," these are the Egyptian magicians, "did so with their secret arts, but they could not." So another line from the Ipuwer Papyrus. "Indeed, all animals, their hearts weep, cattle moan." Exodus 9, verse 3. "Behold, the hand of the Eternal is upon thy cattle. There shall be a very grievous murrain." Back to the Ipuwer Papyrus. "Indeed, everywhere barley has perished." Exodus 9, verse 31. "And the flax and the barley were smitten." Back to the Ipuwer Papyrus. "The land is without light." Exodus 10, verse 22, of course, says, "And there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt." And this goes on and on and on, like for just about every single plague mentioned in the Bible. There's a parallel line relating to something similar happening in Egypt at this time of utter desolation. And it even talks about the Israelites spoiling the Egyptians as well. I'll quickly read this parallel here. "Indeed, poor men have become owners of wealth, and he that could not make sandals for himself is now a possessor of riches. Gold and lapis lazuli, silver and turquoise are strung on the necks of maidservants." and you compare this with the biblical Exodus account, the children of Israel asked of the Egyptians jewels of silver and jewels of gold and raiment. Every woman took of her neighbor jewels of silver, jewels of gold. Like, you go right down the list, and the parallels between this document and the Exodus account are just incredible.
Well, this article that Chris is quoting from here, it's entitled, Did the Israelites Really Live in Egypt? Thanks very much for bringing some of these details to light. The Epiphany Papyrus seems amazing.
Right.
And so if people want more, I think it's definitely worth going to read the article in full. But thanks very much for giving us a taste.
Not a problem.